Chesapeake Bay is the nation's largest estuary, and it's in poor health. That's despite decades of promises to clean it up. Today, the federal government announced the outlines of a new effort to help restore the bay. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
The bay is in trouble largely because it's being overwhelmed with nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediments from agricultural runoff, as well as from the 17 million people who live in the bay's watershed. One of the biggest victims of this has been the bay's once thriving oysters. In a telephone news conference, Peyton Robertson from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said restoring the oysters is key to the new bay recovery effort.
We want to coordinate with Maryland, Virginia, and the Potomac River Fisheries Commission to recover historical oyster bars and establish self-sustaining oyster reef sanctuaries in 20 key tributaries throughout the bay by the year 2020.
Ultimately, the states and federal government will need to figure out how to reduce runoff into the bay. That means paying more attention to farms, which are the single biggest sources of nutrient-laden water. But better farm practices alone won't do the job. In fact, Environmental Protection Agency official Chuck Fox says agricultural runoff has actually been improving somewhat.
This is contrary to urban and suburban runoff loads, which in fact are increasing in the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
So an effective strategy means getting states and local governments to pay more attention to new or rebuilt subdivisions and other development. Up until now, most of the bay's restoration plans have been largely voluntary, loosely coordinated by Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, and the city of Washington, D.C., which are all in the bay's watershed. The new plan, ordered up this spring by President Obama, will give the federal government a much bigger role. Some in the region have worried this could amount to a federal takeover of the effort.
I would respectfully disagree with that characterization completely.
Again, Chuck Fox from the EPA.
It is our view that this is a new era of federal leadership, but it is also our view that we have to do this in close partnership with state and local governments as well as those in the private sector.
States are expected to come up with new regulations and measures to heal the bay, but if those fall short, the federal government will step in with new rules of its own. The plan is still in draft form. It is a big step up from the volunteer efforts of the past two decades, and Bill Dennison at the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science says it's a welcome one.
This is exciting times for Chesapeake Bay. It's kind of a supersized restoration program, and I think it represents an opportunity to take the best studied bay in the world into the best managed bay in the world.
One feature of the plan is that the states and federal government will review their progress every 2 years and not simply wait as the restoration deadline of 2025 draws near.
We have defined goals and measurable progress in realistic time frames. We're not talking about what we're going to do in 5 or 10 years outside the political life cycle of any particular politician, but we're talking about what we can do in a couple years.
Now, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has been the region's leading advocate for restoring the bay. Roy Hoagland at the foundation says the newly unveiled plan lays out neatly all the things that need to be done, but he's not entirely happy.
What was disappointing about this federal strategy is the lack of specificity. For example, it talks about developing new regulations for better managing urban and suburban stormwater. It doesn't have any details of what that better management might or might not be.
Those all-important details still need to be worked out. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's America's largest estuary, and it has undergone decades of cleanup efforts at a cost of billions of dollars. Yet it remains heavily polluted. So today, the Environmental Protection Agency is scheduled to announce a new draft of a plan as it tries to yet again to save the bay. Scientists are still working on this plan. NPR's Christopher Joyce recently hopped aboard the research ship Rachel Carson to see what progress they're making.
Dave Namazi steers a 15-foot skiff through the choppy waters of the Wye River, one of the bay's numerous tributaries. On shore, soybean and cornfields give way to housing developments. Namazi is with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He says 30 years ago, people knew the bay was sick.
But I think there was also really a sense that, in a few years, some hard work, we'll get over this. And we've learned, both in practice, but also just living on the bay, that that's certainly not the case.
Some things are better. Striped bass are back in big numbers. Several rivers, like the Potomac, are cleaner. But there are more dead zones where almost nothing lives. Seagrasses are struggling, and once great harvests of oysters and crabs are a memory. The EPA has now vowed to start over, to do better. But scientists first have to figure out what's actually happening in and especially under the water. That's what determines the bay's basic chemistry.
We've been basically making a map of what the sediments are doing to the water in Chesapeake Bay.
That's Walter Boynton, a marine scientist also with the Science Center. He's aboard the Rachel Carson taking sediment cores. The crew lowers a metal canister into the murky water where it sinks to the bottom and grabs a mud sample. Then it's hauled back on board and its contents retrieved.
There it goes.
These piles of glop are like biopsies. They indicate where the bay is healthy and where it's dying. That will help determine where the EPA needs to crack down on pollutants. Boynton says dead sediments are easy to identify.
They almost feel like if you were making a pot of Jell-O and it hasn't quite congealed yet.
Dead sediments are basically mud with little or no oxygen. Clams and worms and microscopic plants at the bottom of the food chain, down in the mud, need that oxygen. But the bay is oxygen-starved. What it's got instead are nitrogen and phosphorus, way too much of it. The extra nitrogen and phosphorus come mostly from sewage, cars, and fertilizer. They act as nutrients for algae, which gorge on them and grow into huge floating blooms. When the algae die and decompose, that sucks oxygen out of the water, and that's deadly.
The key issue in the Bay program is reduce the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and dirt getting into the bay. We frankly need to know, where does this stuff come from? How long does it hang out here? And where the heck does it go?
Biologist Kristen Politano taps a canister of sediment to get oxygen bubbles to rise. She learned about nutrient pollution in Florida, but in some ways it's just the same here. Scientists can map the pollution hotspots, but someone has to follow them back to the source to fix the problem.
I mean, people get upset about what's going on in the bay, but they have to realize a lot of these problems are coming from the upper watersheds themselves. You have to look at restoring headwater streams and rivers and things like that before you're going to see an improvement in the water quality that's coming into the bay.
Once Boynton measures the oxygen and nutrients in these sediments, the information goes into computer models that EPA can use to figure out where, within this 180-mile-long bay, it needs to spend its new cleanup money and where to crack down on polluters. Like most scientists who've studied the bay, Boynton says progress has been frustratingly slow, but he's optimistic about this new start.
I still maintain that if we start seeing big, big changes in nutrient loads, we will see positive changes in the bay very quickly. And by very quickly, I mean a year or two.
Making that happen, he adds, is up to politicians and the people who vote for them.
This next story helps to explain the last few pounds you've gained. When you eat breakfast, the microbes in your stomach are eating too. Now a new study suggests that a high-fat, high-sugar diet can produce big changes in those microbes, and the changes might actually contribute to obesity. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
Our guts are just teeming with microbes. Jeffrey Gordon studies them at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis.
You have this huge collection of trillions and trillions of microbes that live in our intestines, and one of their functions is to process those components of our diet that we can't digest on our own.
He says who exactly is living in your gut might affect what you get out of food.
The energetic and nutrient value of food may not be an absolute term, but one that is modified in part by the microbes that live in our gut.
For example, recent studies have suggested certain types of gut bacteria are associated with obesity. Gordon wanted to explore all of this in an easy-to-use lab animal, the mouse. So his team took completely germ-free mice and basically fed them human gut bacteria. The result was mice with microbe communities in their guts that mimic the ones found in people. Then the researchers started experimenting. The mice first ate a healthy, low-fat, plant-rich mouse chow. But then they were switched to a high-fat, high-sugar diet. In less than 24 hours, the researchers saw big changes in the animal's gut bacteria.
And we were quite amazed that the community really restructured itself.
Gordon says the unhealthy diet produced microbe winners and losers.
Certain members of that society of microbes became very dominant, and certain members became more diminutive.
To see if this change might mean anything in terms of weight gain, the researchers put these altered communities of bacteria into other germ-free mice. Even though these new mice ate the healthy, low-fat mouse chow, they accumulated extra body fat over the course of the next 2 weeks. The result is reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine. It surprised John Mekalanos. He's chair of the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at Harvard Medical School.
This paper addressed squarely the idea that the microbiota affects our ability to metabolize food in a way that might predispose us to obesity.
He says the ultimate goal would be new therapies for obesity or malnutrition. But to know if that's even possible, scientists have to learn a lot more about what specific bacteria do in our gut. He says this study shows the way ahead because it used DNA sequencing techniques to identify interesting changes in gut microbes.
The tracking of the biota, if you will, using the state-of-the-art new generation sequencing techniques is what makes this paper particularly powerful.
Experiments using these techniques could reveal key microbial players that researchers could then try to manipulate to see what happens. Jeffrey Gordon says they're now planning similar studies using gut bacteria communities from all kinds of people.
We could sample people living in different cultural contexts, eating different diets, and look at the effects of their communities in mice eating the same diets or even different diets.
He says this will let them begin to tease out the complex relationship between human gut microbes, diet, and weight gain or loss. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Nearly all children with some form of autism struggle with social skills. A new study confirms that many also have difficulty with an important motor skill, handwriting. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
For Barbara Wagner's son, Austin, the trouble started when he got to first grade.
We would have nights where it would take 3 hours to do homework.
Austin was a bright kid. He understood the assignments. He knew the answers. Wagner says what was hard for him was writing them down.
He doesn't actually write like you or I would write. He draws his letters. It was almost painful to watch. It took that long.
And Wagner says things got even worse when her son had to do written exercises in class.
This was something that Austin used to tell me all the time. He's like, everybody else is done. And he's like, I'm not done.
Things got better for Austin, who is 14 now, when he was diagnosed with a mild form of autism. That's when his school began to let him answer questions verbally or type on a keyboard. There are a lot of kids like Austin who are on the autism spectrum and have trouble with handwriting. But scientists hadn't really studied the problem much until a group at Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore set out to see whether kids with autism really did have worse handwriting than other kids. Amy Bastian says her team got two groups of children to copy a sentence, then compared the results.
We decided to start with a simple test where you actually measure letters and you score letters based on some qualitative features.
Like how big they are, how they're spaced, and whether they're aligned. Bastian says they tested 14 typical kids and 14 on the autism spectrum, including Barbara Wagner's son, Austin.
It was really striking how robust our findings were on this simple test. Kids really had trouble forming letters.
Kids with autism?
Yes, yes.
The handwriting issue on its own can be a big deal. But Bastian says it's part of a whole other aspect of autism that's now getting attention, difficulties with motor skills. For many kids on the autism spectrum, she says, it's hard to hold a fork, button a shirt, or even play games.
These are the kids that, you know, are going to get picked last for kickball. These are the kids who are clumsy, who have already difficulty relating to other kids, and the motor component probably makes things worse.
Bastian says a lack of motor skills may even contribute to problems these children have communicating.
You understand how someone else is feeling based partially on what they're doing and how you feel when you do those same things. And so if you don't develop a normal motor sort of repertoire, then it's it may be harder for you to understand nonverbal communication from someone else.
Researchers have only been looking at motor skills in autism for a few years, but they've already found a range of subtle problems. And Sarah Spence of the National Institute of Mental Health says that could make it easier to spot very young children with autism. Spence did a study that found these children were slower to reach some key motor milestones.
Sitting up, standing on your own, walking, riding a bicycle.
Spence says this new field of research may challenge some assumptions about children with autism who don't talk.
Some of those children may not want to talk because they have no interest in communicating. Some of them may have such cognitive problems that they really can't understand the concept of communication. But some of them may want to communicate and really just have the motor problem.
The new research appears in the current issue of the journal Neurology. John Hamilton, NPR News.